This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest is Seth MacFarlane, the creator of the animated comedy series Family Guy, American Dad, and The Cleveland Show. He does a lot of voices for the series, like Peter, the father on Family Guy.
How about you all sit there quietly while I make dad noises?
Seth MacFarlane not only does voices on his shows, he often sings in those voices. But on his new album, he sings as himself, rescuing some obscure songs from the American Popular Songbook. It's called Music is Better Than Words. He spoke with Terry last week.
Seth MacFarlane, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you for making this record and for also introducing me to some wonderful songs that I didn't know. You found some wonderful obscure songs, several of them by well-known songwriters. So let's start with one of those. The song is called Anybody's Spring. It's by Johnny Burke and Jimmy Van Heusen, who wrote a lot of songs for Sinatra. I've never heard this one before. So let's get started with having you introduce the song for us and tell us why you chose it.
Yeah, this is an old song from the early 40s called It's Anybody's Spring, and it was featured in the movie Road to Utopia. And it was originally sung by Bob Hope and Bing Crosby. And, you know, I'm a fan of the Road pictures. I remember all the songs from my multiple viewings of those movies. And there's a lot of great songs that I've never heard recorded outside those films, and this was one of them.
Well, it's wonderful. So this is Seth MacFarlane singing It's Anybody's Spring.
You think that money is everything, and yet it's anybody's spring. Go make a fortune, become a king, and still it's anybody's spring. And if you flash a bankroll, do you suppose a brook would care? Or that a rose would say, hey, there goes a millionaire. It's more than diamonds around a ring, because it's anybody's spring. You may be born with a silver spoon, and yet it's anybody's moon. You couldn't buy a ticket to hear the first robin sing. It's free because it's anybody's spring.
So that's Seth MacFarlane, the creator of Family Guy and American Dad, and this is from his new CD, Music is Better Than Words. So it's amazing to hear you singing without irony, like you're not singing a Stewie, you know, you're not singing as a cartoon yeah. character. There's no quotes around what you're doing. You're just
right.
You're singing your heart out, and it sounds really good. Is it odd for you as a performer to be doing something that's not comedy, that's not ironic, that's not in quotes?
You know, it's I suppose it's odd for the audience initially. For me, no. I mean, I've been doing this kind of thing actually for years with you know, various jazz bands. One of my composers, Ron Jones, has a group called the Influence Jazz Orchestra that he performs with throughout L.A., and I go and sing with him, and we do old, you know, old Nelson Riddle, Billy May charts. And this kind of music has always been what I've been drawn to. The Great American Songbook, and particularly the early to late 50s era of orchestration.
So were you exposed to the music of the 50s and to Sinatra and Rosemary Clooney, Bing Crosby, through your parents or your grandparents? What did they listen to, and what impact did that have on you?
You know, my parents exposed me to the great Broadway shows and the great movie musicals of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. As far as the jazz, cousin Shep introduced me to Woody Allen when I was a kid, and I instantly became a huge fan of his movies, and obviously so many of his movies feature that kind of music. When Radio Days came out, I bought the soundtrack and got to know all the songs, one of which is on this record, You and I, which was written by Meredith Willson. And, you know, that's it was an old Sinatra song from the 40s, and it's a song that we put on the album. But Radio Days was full of that kind of music. And so I went to my grandfather, and I was like, gosh, this is your era. Do you have any more of this kind of stuff? And he gave me a bunch of his old record albums. And so I really became acquainted with, you know, with Tommy Dorsey, with Glenn Miller, with that era of music. And it wasn't really till I was in college that I started to discover what the 50s had to offer and the early 60s. And that was really what kind of got me excited.
Were you in musicals when you were in high school?
I was, yeah. My sister and I did a lot of...
What were your big numbers?
Well, when I was... I started young. When I was about 9 years old, I was in The Sorcerer, the Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. And it was put on by a local theater organizer named Marty Holcomb, who was kind of introduced us all to the works of Gilbert and Sullivan. We did The Sorcerer, we did The Mikado, we did the HMS Pinafore. And then when I got into high school, Anything Goes, I remember, Little Shop of Horrors, Carousel. So a real wide variety of shows. But yeah, I was always involved with that stuff.
So when you were young, were you in The Music Man? Because you seem to like Meredith Wilson, who wrote the score.
I was never. That's one of my big regrets. I was never in The Music Man, and I always loved that show.
Mm-hmm.
Loved that show. Loved every song from that show.
Well, your new album gives you the opportunity to do a song from that show, and I thought
yes.
We'd play that one now. It's called "The Sadder But Wiser Girl for Me," and you do it with a lot of pizzazz. I like this a lot. Do you want to say anything about choosing it?
You know, this is a song that, in keeping with our goal of choosing less performed material for this record, this is a song that you don't really hear recorded in pop music. I don't know that I've ever heard. I'm sure they're out there. I have never heard a recording of this song outside the.
Me neither. Unlike, say, 76 Trombones.
Right. There's a lot of recordings of that. But no, I've never heard the Sadder But Wiser Girl recorded, and it's such a likely candidate for like a really, really, you know, barn burner of a swing tune.
Okay, so this is Seth MacFarlane from his new album, Music Is Better Than Words.
No sweet and pure angelic lass for me. That kind of gal can spin a web, you see. She trades on wholesome innocence galore, but it's my independence that she's trading for. The only affirmative she will file refers to marching down the aisle. No golden, glorious, gleaming, pristine goddess. No, sir. For no Diana do I play for, and I can tell you that right now. I snarl, I hiss, how can ignorance be compared to bliss? I spark, I fizz, for the lady who knows what time it is. I cheer, I rave, for the virtue I'm too late to save. The sadder but wiser girl for me. No bright-eyed, blushing, breathless baby doll baby. No, sir, that kind of child ties knots. No sailor ever knew. I prefer to take a chance on a more adult romance. No dewy young miss who keeps resisting. All the time she keeps insisting. No wide-eyed, wholesome, innocent female. Why, she's the fisherman, I'm the fish, you'll see.
That's Seth MacFarlane from his new album, Music Is Better Than Words, and it's his first album singing in his own voice. He's known best as the creator of Family Guy, American Dad, and The Cleveland Show, three comedy animated series. So, you know, we've talked a little bit about choosing songs to sing on your new album. Let's talk about writing the theme for Family Guy, because this is the curtain raiser every week. It's a big production number. There's actually, you know, top hat and cane and chorus line. And the theme seems modeled in part on the All in the Family theme that, you know, Archie and Edith Bunker used to sit at the piano and sing, you know, waxing nostalgic about the olden days.
Right. Tonally, yeah, and you actually see the, you know, Peter and Lois sitting there at the piano at the beginning. Yeah, you know, thematically, it is very much you know, in the same vein. I think the difference is we're speaking a bit more. I think that was a very sincere opening with Family Guy. It's a bit more sardonic. There's a bit more irony to the tone for obvious reasons.
Yes, in part that you're so crude, you'd hardly
be yearning for the olden days.
Like,
it's like, where are all those nice, friendly, happy family TV shows that we remember? Here's one.
So was this one of your first outings writing a song?
It was, yeah. Yeah. You know, I luckily had the music of Walter Murphy to work with. I mean, this is a great melody writer. He's written, you know, three themes for us. You know, the Family Guy theme, American Dad theme, and the Cleveland Show theme. And the movie that I've just finished directing, Ted, he's composed two songs for that. He's just really his stuff is very easy to set lyrics to.
So let's hear the Family Guy theme. And so this is music by Walter Murphy and lyrics by my guest, Seth MacFarlane, the creator of the show.
It seems today that all you see is violence in movies and sex on TV.
But where are those good old-fashioned values on which we used to rely?
And cry.
He's a Family Guy.
So that's the Family Guy theme, the animated TV show created by my guest Seth MacFarlane.
And that was, you know, it's funny. And one of the few remaining, and it's a shame, but one of the few remaining television themes that airs every week. It's a tradition that's kind of going away, and part of that is that the networks are worried that people don't want to sit through the same thing week after week, that people are going to change the channel. And so shows are being discouraged from writing themes. We actually had to fight pretty hard to be able to do a theme, because I thought, no, people aren't going to want it's going to bore people. They're going to switch away. And I think what they don't realize is that, no, this is showmanship is showmanship. It hasn't changed in hundreds of years. It's a drum roll. It basically says, yeah, hey, here comes a show. It's Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck walking out onto the stage doing, you know, this is it. And, it gets the audience psyched up. You know, it's really tragic that networks are letting that go away. I mean, the tradition of television theme songs is a pretty rich one.
Seth MacFarlane speaking with Terry Gross. MacFarlane is the creator of the animated series Family Guy, American Dad, and The Cleveland Show. Let's hear a clip from Family Guy, in which Peter, Stewie, Brian, and Chris are engaged in a bet as to who will get the last piece of pie in the fridge. MacFarlane voices three of the characters.
All right, you guys, I got 8 crates of Epicac from Mort, all on my tab. Now, whoever goes the longest without puking gets the last piece of pie in the fridge. Okay, here we go. How's everybody doing?
Good so far.
All right.
Nothing yet.
Cool. You know, I don't know if you guys had any of that pie already, but that is some tasty stuff. That's from the bake sale that Lois would...
Ooh, one down. I know somebody who won't be having any...
I'm starting to feel funny.
Well, I feel fine. I guess I'm going to...
Oh, boy! That means I win! I get to eat...
Oh, God! Why didn't anybody tell me?
Oh, my God! My insides are on fire!
No, please! No more!
Dad, I'm scared!
Get the phone! Call 911!
Lois! Lois, get in here!
Okay, I think it's all gone. I think it's...
I don't want to...
Peter, I need you to hold my ears.
Who wants chowder?
That's a clip from the animated series Family Guy, prominently featuring our guest and the creator of the show, Seth MacFarlane. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Seth MacFarlane, the creator of the animated series Family Guy, American Dad, and The Cleveland Show. He does a lot of voices for his shows and often sings in character. Now he has a new album singing as himself, rescuing obscure songs from the American Popular Songbook. It's called Music is Better Than Words. Terry asked MacFarlane about the difference between singing in character and singing in his own voice.
Singing in character voices is actually, people ask often, is it hard? And it's like, no, it's actually a hell of a lot easier than singing straight.
Why?
Because you're singing in a character voice, it's almost like there's a shield of sorts around it, because we assume Peter Griffin probably shouldn't be able to sing all that well, so you can kind of keep it loose and you don't have to really think too much about it. It's more work to sing straight.
Well, how about singing in Stewie's voice? Can you talk in his voice for a second?
Why don't you talk in his voice? I'm sick to death of it. You draggle-tailed, blunt-edged gutter-snipe.
Okay, but now, singing in his voice has to be tricky, no?
You know, again, not really, because it's not like you have to maintain shades of subtlety. It's Stewie. I mean, it's Stewie singing is essentially Rex Harrison singing in My Fair Lady. I mean,
Stewie sings better than Rex Harrison. Stewie has more range than Rex Harrison has.
Maybe a little bit. Maybe after that Bryan Adams song, yeah. But again, it doesn't have to be as rich. Doesn't have to be quite as textured. It's a different type of character than the character that you try to put into a straight ballad or a straight swing tune.
So let's get back to the creation of Family Guy. What was the basic idea that the series grew out of?
Well, I mean, I had been studying animation for a while, been interested in animation. And when The Simpsons came about, I, at the time, was really interested in becoming an animator for Disney. Disney was having sort of their renaissance in the film world with movies like The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast. And that was what I wanted to do. And then here comes The Simpsons that says, hey, you know what? You can also do this. We're completely rewriting the rule book with regard to what you can do on television. And I was laughing. You know, this is something that actually was for me. It wasn't for necessarily for a family audience. Like me as a single guy with sort of an edgier sense of humor in what I was looking for. I was doing stand-up at the time and, you know, enjoying that and enjoying working with kind of more risque humor. And so I decided to develop an animated idea. And, you know, I looked to my own region, in this case, where I was brought up, for character ideas. And, you know, Peter Griffin is very, very much the quintessential big, fat, you know, loud New England guy who is very, very good at the core, big-hearted guy, but just has zero self-editing mechanism, you know, no yeah. idea what is appropriate and inappropriate. And you kind of have to forgive him because he just doesn't know any better. And I knew so many of those guys. My father knew tons of those guys when we were living back east.
Was he one of them?
My father, no. Ironically, my father was very much, you know, very liberal, very intellectual, but a lot of his friends were, you know, more like Peter.
Okay, to illustrate your point about Peter having, like, no sense of what's appropriate, this is a scene from the 100th episode of Family Guy, and Peter and his wife Lois are on a cruise, and they have the privilege of sitting for dinner at the captain's table. And as this clip begins, the captain is telling this inspiring story, and then Peter talks next.
And that was the first time I saw the Northern Lights at their peak. And as I gazed, astonished at their lustrous brilliance, I turned to my first mate and I said, "We are looking into the very eyes of God."
Ah, what a wonderful story.
All right, I got one for you. So me and Lois are driving up to Vermont to get this abortion.
Peter!
Just, hang on, Lois, don't ruin it. All right, so we're driving up to get this abortion, and we get to the abortion clinic. And the abortionist has one hand.
Peter, for God's
sake. I'll tell it. So I turn to Lois and I says, "You want to get an abortion here? You want to get an abortion with the abortionist having a stump hand? We can't get an abortion here." So we turned around and went home, and 2.5 months later, our daughter Meg was born.
I love that taxpayer dollars just paid for you to air that. This is national public radio.
That is such a funny clip.
This is why the Republicans hate us.
But it's like if you want to get an inappropriate story, there you go.
Yeah.
And
ironically, the DVD version of that episode has about 8 more uses of the word abortion.
I also love watching couples fight about how to tell a story and whether to tell a story.
Yeah.
And that's just like the quintessential version of it.
Pretty much.
So what kind of reaction did you get to that scene?
You know, we never really know what is going to raise the ire of the more conservative members of our audience. I don't think we ever really got any flack from that.
Because it's not really about whether abortion is right or wrong. It's about how wildly inappropriate he is in his storytelling.
He just doesn't know. I mean, it's an extreme example, but it's like that, you know, from my experience back east, not that extreme.
Now, did you grow up with a baby brother? Because like Stewie is this like diabolical 1-year-old who tries to kill his mother. So did you have a baby in your life when you were growing up?
I did not. You know, Stewie was originally just kind of a dopey-looking drawing of a baby with no personality. And I had the rest of the family conceived, and I was just sort of looking for something that would give him more of a personality than you know, just a mute baby, which is essentially, you know, what Maggie Simpson was. You know, I was a big Rex Harrison fan. There was something about him that I just found inherently amusing and ridiculous. And so I came up with this idea to put essentially Rex Harrison's voice in the body of this baby. And thus Stewie was born. And I didn't really think he was going to be anything special. I thought, you know, our Peter will be the breakout character, if anyone is. And Stewie will just be something that, you know, amuses me. He'll be kind of this funny side character that pipes in now and then. And, you know, you just never know what the audience is going to respond to, because obviously Stewie turned out to be the biggest draw of the show.
And what about Brian the dog? Did you have pets?
I did have pets, yeah. I had a lot of dogs. A lot of dogs. And, you know, the Brian-Peter relationship was really the first thing to come about in very rough form in a student film that I did in college. And it's a very kind of old-fashioned comedy duo relationship. It's very vaudevillian in a way at its core. You know, it's like big loud comedy guy and, you know, more serious straight guy, you know, going back and forth with each other. I mean, it's a very old-fashioned comedy relationship they have in a lot of ways.
Did you feel you ever had that kind of relationship with your dog?
Not really. My dogs did not speak. They just, you know, ran around, barked, and threw up.
I guess that's sufficient, right?
Yeah.
Seth MacFarlane, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been fun. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you.
Seth MacFarlane speaking with Terry Gross. MacFarlane created Family Guy, American Dad, and The Cleveland Show. His new album of American popular song is called Music is Better Than Words. You can hear 3 tracks from it at our website, freshair.npr.org. This month marks the centenary of the birth of sci-fi and adventure writer Jack Finney. Finney gave readers a vivid time travel fantasy in his best-selling novel, Time and Again, and an enduring nightmare in his story, The Body Snatchers, later renamed Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has this appreciation.
Sometimes the stories that stay with us aren't the classics or even all that polished. They're what some critics call good, bad stories. The writing may be workmanlike and the characters barely developed, but something about them is so potent that they're unforgettable. So unforgettable, they can attain the status of myth. I've long wanted to give a nod to one of these accidental mythmakers, novelist and short story writer Jack Finney. The fact that Finney would have turned 100 this month gives me an occasion. Finney started out in advertising before he became a sci-fi and suspense writer, and maybe that background accounts for the pithiness of his writing and the intensity of his images, images that bore into your brain like a parasite. Who's Jack Finney, you may ask? The two-word answer is pod people. In 1954, Finney published a serialized novel in Collier's magazine called The Body Snatchers. Later paperback editions altered the title to Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The novel was dissed for its plot inconsistencies, and the B-movie that was made of it in 1956 was largely ignored by critics. That same movie was selected in 1994 for preservation in the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. Three serious remakes have been made, as well as a bunch of dopier imitations, like the 2007 direct-to-DVD opus Invasion of the Pod People, in which aliens take over the bodies of presumably heterosexual women and turn them into lesbians, perfect for viewing during October, LGBT History Month. Parodies also abound of Finney's classic tale, among them Invasion of the Muppet Snackers and Invasion of the Bunny Snatchers, starring Bugs Bunny. The term pod, used to connote a blank person, has become so much a part of everyday speech that even people who've never seen the movies or read Finney's novel know the gist of the nightmare he gave to America. It unfolds as follows. In a sunny California town that Finney calls Santa Mira, some residents have started acting so strangely, flat affect, robotic speech, that their loved ones believe them to be imposters. To his horror, the town doctor, Miles Bunnell, discovers that giant pods from outer space have been colonizing the town, replicating people's bodies and memories as they sleep. Feelings are the only human dimension the alien pods can't absorb. One by one, the human holdouts succumb to sleep and erasure, until only Miles is left to warn the rest of the country. Here's the famous ending of the original movie. Miles, played by Kevin McCarthy, is dodging traffic on a crowded highway at night, trying to warn drivers of the invasion. Ever since Finney's novel and the first film version appeared, critics have been generating theories about why this story has taken root, so to speak, in our collective imagination. The pods seem to mean all things to all critics. Lately, a post-colonialist interpretation of the pods as imperialists is popular. But given the 1950s context, the pods are most commonly seen as either symbols of the communist menace or, conversely, of McCarthyite groupthink. Finney himself always insisted that his book wasn't a Cold War novel or a metaphor for anything. "I wrote it," he said, "to entertain its readers, nothing more." Maybe. But like so many other great genre writers, James M. Cain, Shirley Jackson, even, Shudder, Mickey Spillane, Finney had a knack for unearthing shallowly buried psychological anxieties. His work, and I'm thinking here also of his haunting New York City time travel novel, Time and Again, is suffused with a sense of nostalgia, loss, and powerlessness. "People we love can change," Invasion of the Body Snatchers tells us, "and sometimes that change is terrifying. Lovers turn inexplicably cold. Elderly parents succumb to dementia, Alzheimer's. People may look the same on the outside. They don't turn into vampires or zombies, but inside they're vacant." That's why Finney's myth of pod people really hits home. Why it's still one of the saddest scary stories ever told. When we read about or hear Miles Bunnell shouting, "You're next," on that nighttime highway, we know he's right. And there's nothing any of us can do about it.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Maybe it's just a coincidence, but Colson Whitehead's new novel has been published in the middle of a zombie craze. His novel, Zone 1, is set in Manhattan after a plague has spread around the world, turning many of the infected into zombies. When the novel begins, the worst of the plague is over, and New York's provisional government is trying to restore some semblance of normal life. The main character, Mark Spitz, is part of Omega Team, tasked with cleaning out the remaining zombies. Colson Whitehead is a recipient of the MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Award. His novel John Henry Days, about a journalist assigned to write about the legendary John Henry, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. His semi-autobiographical novel Sag Harbor is about summering in a middle-class African-American community in the Hamptons. He spoke with Terry last week.
Colson Whitehead, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with a reading from Zone 1, and you want to just set it up for us?
Sure. In this section, Mark Spitz, our humble protagonist, is hiding out. The end times have come, and he's found a refuge with a woman named Mim in a toy store in Connecticut. And he's mulling over how he got here and trying to process how much the world has changed. The boy that wandered the cellar of his personality still nursed the naive hunger for a life of adventure. As a kid, he'd invented scenarios for adulthood: to outrun a fireball, swing across the air shaft on a wire, dismember the gargoyle army with an enchanted blade that only he could hold. Now he was grown up, and the plague had granted him his wish and rendered it a silly grotesque. It was not so glamorous to spend 2 days doubled over, emptying your guts because you'd gambled on the expired bottle of kiwi juice. All the other kids turned out to be postal workers, roofers, beloved teachers, and died. Mark Spitz was living the dream. Take a bow, Mark Spitz. And then he goes on to think about all the movies and TV shows he loved as a kid and the monsters in them. He loved the subgenre of misunderstood aliens and mechanical men who yearned to love. He'd always seen himself in them, the robots who roved the galaxy in search of the emotion chip, the tentacled things that were, beneath their mottled, puckered membranes, more human than the murderous villagers who hunted them down for their difference. The townspeople, of course, were the real monsters. It was the business of the plague to reveal our family members, friends, and neighbors as the creatures they'd always been. And what had the plague exposed him to be? Mark Spitz endured as the race was killed off one by one. A part of him thrived on the end of the world. How else to explain it? He had a knack for apocalypse. The plague touched them all, blood contact or no. The secret murderers, dormant rapists, and latent fascists were now free to express their ruthless natures. The timid, those who had been stingy with their dreams for themselves, those who came out of the womb scared and remained so, these too found a final stage for their weakness, and in their last breaths were fulfilled. I've always been like this. Now I'm more me.
That's Colson Whitehead reading from his new novel, Zone One. So let's talk about the scenario that you've created. What is the plague that destroys so much of New York?
The plague is a zombie plague, and I'm still trying to get over saying zombie out loud so many times a day. And the infected and the dead are about 95% of the population, and then there are the survivors. And the plague is running down. They're rebuilding society. There are camps of survivors here and there across the country. And now they decided to tackle New York. It's an island. You can go through and sweep out the remaining zombies, the plague-ridden wretches. And our hero, Mark Spitz, is part of a team of sweepers. The army has swept out most of the creatures. And Omega Team, Mark's team, is going door-to-door in residential buildings, office buildings, and getting that remaining 1% of the monsters who are lurking in closets and in storerooms so that they can resettle Manhattan and bring the survivors home.
So the people who are left include the living, the Skells, and the stragglers. What are Skells?
The Skells are what we know as conventional zombies, slow-moving. They gain their horrific potential in groups. And then there are stragglers, which I added to the mix. And stragglers are malfunctioning zombies. They're human statues. Once they've been infected, they go to places that were important to them, places that are emotionally charged. So if you were a lawyer, you might follow your homing instinct and go to your office and sit in your chair and wait for clients who never come. If you're a shrink, you might go to your office and wait for patients who are probably not going to show up for their 1 o'clock appointment. So downtown is littered with these stragglers, these human statues who are representing some sort of aspect of their past.
Do the zombies in your book have any consciousness of the fact that they're zombies?
As far as the zombies, we don't know what they're thinking. I doubt it's that complicated. I'm kind of hungry. Whole Foods is closed, so I'll go after this guy right here. Part of what I'm trying to do in the book is erase that line between the infected and the uninfected. The stragglers are tied to emotionally charged places in their past, and so are their survivors. They're also ghosts haunting themselves, the people that used to be, the homes, their homes that no longer exist. So whether you have the plague in your blood or not, you're kind of zombie-like, is what I'm trying to say, I think.
Now, Buffalo, New York, has become the home of the provisional government, and the best and the brightest have been sent there to rewind the catastrophe. And in return, they have a 24-hour-a-day generator and uncurtailed hot showers on command, which is a really big deal in this post-apocalyptic world. And one of the things they're tackling in the provisional government is language, trying to describe the post-plague world. They're rebranding the survival. They have specialists crafting the new language. What were some of your inspirations for this rebranding?
When I was conceiving of the novel, I just had the idea that people are pretty much the same after the disaster. They're just a little more bummed out. And so it seems that marketing will come back pretty quickly, bureaucracy, all those sorts of things. And if you are trying to marshal a very depressed populace towards a new future, you are going to need a song. Stop, Can You Hear the Eagle Roar, which is a, you know, sort of the uplifting anthem that people are humming under their breath. You're going to need a name for this new class of people, the American Phoenix, we're rising from the ashes. So it seemed that that kind of corporate sloganeering would come back pretty early, along with the desire for gourmet coffee, fresh arugula, and all those sorts of nice things that we associate with contemporary society.
So why are zombies and vampires so popular now? Why do you think?
I wish I could tell you. I mean, my strange affinity goes back to when I was a kid. I read a lot of horror novels and watched a lot of horror movies, B-movies, good horror movies like The Thing, bad movies like Horror of Party Beach. And I was definitely too young to see these things. So I saw Dawn of the Dead in junior high.
That's one of the Romero films, George Romero films.
Yes, the second one, zombie classic. And it was rated X, no one under 18 admitted. But my parents took me and my brother on a family outing. It was very pleasant. And since then, I've had zombie anxiety dreams. So some people have anxiety dreams about showing up for an exam they didn't know, for a class they didn't know they had, or having to give a presentation and they're unprepared. I've had zombie anxiety dreams for the last 30 years, and sometimes they're fast, they're slow, I'm alone with friends in the city or the country, basically depending on what's going on in my life. And this book started from a dream I had 2.5 years ago. Finally, one of my dreams was useful. I was out in the country with some house guests. It was very lovely, and I had this dream that I wanted to go out into the living room of my house, but I was wondering if they'd swept the zombies out yet. And then I woke up, and usually when you have a dream and you're sort of aware of it, it's a dream, and you think, I have to remember this when I wake up, it's going to be a good book, and then we wake up and it's terrible. This time I woke up and thought, this is a real actual logistical nightmare. How do you get rid of the zombies when you're trying to rebuild society? And that's how the book started for me.
So your parents took you to see Dawn of the Dead, even though it was rated X. And it was rated X because it was so graphic. I mean, the zombies are like eating, like they're just like chewing on legs and arms. It's really, really gory film. And you had zombie nightmares ever since. So did your parents do the right thing or the wrong thing by taking you to see that exceptionally gory zombie film?
I got a book out of it.
30 years later.
30 years later. So it paid off. I mean, I think We didn't have babysitters, my brother and I. We would just go to Crazy Eddie, which was an old video store in New York City, every Friday and rent Betamax tapes of late 70s splatter movies and classic horror movies, Dario Argento, and have these horror film festivals. And until college, I wanted to write horror novels. I wanted to write The Black Shining or the Black Salem's Lot. Basically, if you took any Stephen King title and put The Black in front of it, that was sort of my aspiration.
So when you were young, you wanted to write The Black, The Shining, or take any Stephen King novel and put The Black in front of it. So what's going on racially in your new novel? Is your character African-American? Is he white? Is race an issue? Is it a post-racial world in the post-apocalyptic world?
You know, I mean, the use of the word post-racial is so funny these days. Folks think that because Obama was elected, suddenly racism disappeared the day after on November 6th. And of course it didn't. We don't live in a post-racial world. However, it seems when folks have the apocalypse on their plate, or at least it seemed to me, that racial differences, class differences, your funny accent, these things aren't as important as finding that last can of peas and maybe a bag of beef jerky that will get you through a couple days' food.
And making sure that the person isn't a zombie.
Yes, that helps. Yeah. That helps.
right.
So Zone 1 is a post-racial world simply because they have more things on their mind than skin color, gender difference.
Now, when you were growing up in Manhattan, you went to prep school. And you said you were often the only African-American in the room. And when you'd go to a bar mitzvah, which you did a lot growing up in Manhattan.
It was a great time. I mean, that was my introduction to chicken on skewers, finger food. You know, I look back very fondly.
Little egg rolls?
Yes. Oh, God.
So how did that shape your sense of what it meant to be black?
It didn't shape my sense of what it is to be black. It helped with my outsiderness. And I think if you're an outsider, as you are in a predominantly white prep school, you become an observer. You start to think about where you end and other folks begin, the sort of alien community that you're part of, half-digested, trying to navigate. But that kind of otherness can be found in so many sectors of daily experience. And I try to tackle that in Sag Harbor. We have this prep school kid who divides his time between New York City, where he's in a mostly white environment in school, and an African-American community in Sag Harbor in the Hamptons, a middle-class, upper-middle-class enclave. And he toggles back and forth between an all-black society and a mostly white society and tries to figure out who he is and who he's becoming.
In Sag Harbor, your semi-autobiographical novel about summering in the Hamptons in an African-American summering community there, the character describes his parents as being from the uplift the race category. And I'm wondering if you would describe your parents that way too, and if so, how did that relate to their expectations of you?
There's some of that in their personality. You know, they're the civil rights generation, and I'm the product of their struggles and what they and their aspirations and what they wanted for their kids. And they're the product of their parents' strivings, being the first doctors, lawyers in their family, this newly emergent black middle class in the 20s. So they had they wanted me to have a decent job and make a lot of money. And when I told them I wanted to be a writer, they weren't incredibly psyched. I mean, I was fortunate to get a job working at the Village Voice and supporting myself doing journalism, not supporting myself in a very lofty style, but I had money for beer, and that helped. And even when I was being a journalist, they sort of didn't understand and assumed I would get with the program and become a lawyer. And I think it wasn't until my first book, The Intuitionist, came out that they were fully on board. They could actually see a review of it in a newspaper and say, oh, it's actually something that's real. And even if he didn't go into investment banking or brain surgery, he can take care of himself.
One of your first book jobs, perhaps your very first book job, was working at the Village Voice, the first, I think it's fair to say, the first really big alternative weekly newspaper. And you were, what, assistant book review editor? Or assistant to the book review editor?
Yeah, I was about 6 months out of college, and it was my job to open the 40 books a day we got from publishers, file them, answer the phones. I had to get a phone voice because I was a big mumbler, so voice literary supplement. that was a real milestone for me. And, I mean, it was a great time and a great opportunity. I'm not sure how kids find journalism jobs these days. But because, you know, the Village Voice thought of itself as a writer's paper, if you hung around and badgered folks, you would get an assignment. And if it was okay, you'd get a second one. And so I started off in the TV section because the editor seemed like an easy mark. And he gave me an assignment, and that led to other stuff. So I never took any creative writing classes in college. I tried to audition for them, and I was turned down both times. But I became a writer at The Voice, filing once a week. If you write a good article, you get great feedback. Good job, Coulson. If you are too self-indulgent and spend the first four paragraphs talking about your romantic woes or why you're depressed, you hear nothing, so you know you sort of screwed up and maybe you should not be so voice-oriented and more attentive to the job at hand. And that gave me the confidence to start writing fiction, even though I'd only written maybe, four stories in my whole life.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a lot of fun. Got me out of the house. Always a big plus in my world.
Are you still a shut-in?
Yeah, well, working home, you're right, you're working home. So those are the rhythms of my days.
And that suits you?
Yes, I like it just fine.
Coulson Whitehead speaking with Terry Gross. His new novel is Zone One. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.